This is Richard Verone, and I am continuing my oral history interview with Colonel Jack Keith. It is 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, October 25th, Friday morning. Colonel Keith, we left off yesterday discussing, we're just starting to discuss the Tet Offensive and your experiences with that. You said when the offensive began, you were inbound back to Benoit. Is that correct?
Yes, I had gone to the States to see my wife during both of the fighter pilots. Within that year, you had one shot where you could meet your wife in Hawaii or mm-hmm. normally Hawaii. But
right.
in my case, I was able to go all the way home. So I came to Miami and. Then on my way back, mm-hmm. I was, I got to get rid of my little puppy here a minute.
Okay.
I was on my way back in a 130, I believe it was, into Tansanute and then into the airbase. And that Tet happened that night.
Okay.
The night, the morning, I arrived the morning after the evening of Tet.
Okay. Okay.
And everything was still kind of in a chaos there at the base because many of the VC came aboard. And I don't think we had too many casualties, but I believe they had quite a few, and then there were some prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a little bit of that in my memoirs, too, with some few pictures.
Yes, sir. What kind of activities did you have there at Benoit?
We had, the 3rd TAC fighter wing with three fighter squadrons, plus we had a few air defense birds dispersed within our local area, which were out of their parent outfit was in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
But that outfit in the Philippines, 405th, I believe it was, had a few of these F-102 air-to-air birds positioned at several of the bases, including our base there, Benoit. So we must have had about 6 of them, I guess, right out in front of our operation.
Okay. And during this attack, was anything, any equipment damaged, any of the birds damaged?
No, I don't think there's anything substantial. Right, just maybe a few bullet holes and what I'd be skirmishing
mm-hmm.
with these people on the ground. But we had... We always had the Army troops on our perimeter
mm-hmm.
with their various equipment, and they took them on, and a few of them did get aboard, and I think most of them were killed. I think there's up somewhere around 70, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay, okay. What was your feeling about, immediately after Tet and then, say, the 4 or 5 weeks after Tet, what was your feeling? Had the war changed, in your opinion, from what you could observe?
No, I didn't see any great change. We continued on just like we always did with our
mm-hmm.
our daily frag orders and went out and did what we were supposed to do and mm-hmm. didn't remember any problem. I picked up a little on the rocket damage on our base. They launched
okay.
rockets. It got to the point that it was almost every night.
Hmm.
And that was kind of interesting.
Did you increase your number of sorties during the day after Tet?
No, I don't believe so. I think we went on pretty much the same.
Okay. Okay. What could you tell about the overall American policy? This 1968 going into 1969, did you feel like the United States was winning the war or making progress in the war, or were you more separated from that political atmosphere?
Yeah, we didn't see too much of that. We heard that, there's a little problem in the States
mm-hmm.
around some of the colleges with the students displaying
mm-hmm.
against the war over there, but I really never noticed anything much as far as changes. It,
mm-hmm.
We just continued on pretty much the same way that I had from the beginning.
Right. Okay. What can you say about the media coverage of the war? Were you exposed a lot to the press as the commander of the 531st?
No. I don't recall any press people. We have visits occasionally by the high-ranking military, our generals and so on from
mm-hmm.
the States would come in and
mm-hmm.
and sit within the squadron. We'd brief them, and there'd be occasionally a reporter or two. I remember in my stay over there, every once in a while, they would put somebody in the back seat of an F, and I would fly them.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew two or three of those people. I think they were probably press type.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't ask me much. They just milled around there in the on the base for a little bit, I guess maybe asking questions of some of the people on the line.
Mm-hmm.
But and then Ted Kennedy popped in one day.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see it. I saw him land, and I was riding around in a Jeep,
mm-hmm.
reconnoitering the runways, and I was going to go over and pick him up. A helicopter came and dropped him off at the base of the control tower.
Mm-hmm.
And before I get over, a Jeep whipped up something that he probably had scheduled, and he took off, and then never saw him again.
You never got to meet him and talk
no.
to him? Now, you did have one interesting... well, first, before I ask that, look, you took an actual couple of members of the press up on one of your sorties?
Yes.
That's interesting. Now, who gave the orders for that, or that came from, I guess, above?
Yeah. It probably came out of 7th Air Force. I imagine we'd probably had a written letter of some type, and to come in and talk to the wing commander.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would... wing commander would talk to, in our case, talk to squad, well, me,
mm-hmm.
and or the DO, who is my boss,
mm-hmm.
deputy of operations, and he would ask me, do you mind taking somebody up in the back seat? And one time it happened to be the commanding general, Momeyer.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. You had General Momeyer
right.
on one of your runs. Tell me about that experience. What was that like?
Yeah, that was the DO again just asked me one day if I would mind taking the commander up in the back seat, and I
mm-hmm.
said no, it'd be fine. So we were set up on the alert pad where you only have three or four airplanes ready to go on
mm-hmm.
5-minute alert, and so we excuse me, we briefed there on a pre-planned attack which came from his operational people in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and of course they wanted to try to get him a good target and something interesting. So I told the DO I'd be glad to take him up. So we briefed there in the alert pad on that pre-planned unit, which normally out of that pad you go off on emergencies where they hot things that happen, you know, within minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they call you and you go. But on that one it was pre-planned, so we briefed. General Momeyer kind of sat there to one side, and he got aboard, and we took off, had a flight of three. And I don't know how much I put in your, what information you have there, but
mm-hmm.
we went off to certain coordinates to contact an airborne FAC, and which we did. He took us, we're heading towards this, the target, and command post came on and said, we got another target, a different target for you.
Now, is that because they were trying to find a really good
yeah.
one for him? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, first, the one we were going for, they thought, I guess, was pretty good. And
mm-hmm.
so his people in the command post there in Tansanute said, go for this particular one,
mm-hmm.
number one. And like I said, we were just really getting together and smoking towards that target.
Mm-hmm.
And they came on and said, we got a target change. And so he didn't say anything. And they gave us some more coordinates and another FAC call sign. And so we turned off to a degree and went for this man. And we had probably gone off on that heading for 5 or 10 minutes. And they said, we got another change. So they came in for the third time, gave us these coordinates. And at that point, General Momeyer kind of commented in the back seat and said, kind of tough, getting a real good target, and his troops are just trying to get, something real fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were some reporters back at Benoit
mm-hmm.
waiting for him to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on to the third target, which we finally hit, and we had bombed and strafed. And he had...
Do you remember what target that was, sir?
Gee, no. I sure don't. And... So was it? He had commented to the wing commander. I didn't know about it, but he had said, he said, I hope this pilot doesn't go up there and go through some of these killing maneuvers, you know, all these steep dives and Mach G pullouts, because he wasn't too fond of that. And but I always used a nice 30-degree dive, no matter what I use, whether it's rockets, bombs, napalm, or strafe, and because one reason, you can get real proficient. And so I had these nice, easy deals, fast, up around probably 500 knots in these shallow dives. And so that thrilled him to death, I guess. And when we came home, the news media with their cameras and so on got some pictures of him. And I think he ended up in Time magazine or one of those about that time.
His his photo there on the runway, or
he was just standing there beside the airplane, you know, and they it looked like, I don't know, half a dozen of them kind of ganged around him. I imagine some of them were, I'm sure, some of them are probably military types, you know, reporting type, and so that was it. And a couple of days later, he sent us down a nice letter and said that it was a good run. He had flown hundreds on his own.
I think
several years before. I think he was a Thunderbird too, and so he indicated that it was a good run, and it brought back good memories of the times that he had flown the airplane. And he didn't really bubble you over. He just said, you've accomplished what I expect, or something like that.
Right.
And I've got a copy of that letter in my memoirs.
Right, I read that.
Did you?
Yes, sir. How much talk was there on the radio when you were flying out to the targets? And was he, you know, what were you guys talking about, if at all?
Yeah, I'd be talking primarily in flight lead with the FAC, and going ahead and talking about the fix, where it was, what the target was, and things like that. And my wingmen, they're all listening, but they don't say much unless I ask them for something. And he didn't say anything other than that comment about after that third change, you know. He commented something. Other than that, I don't think he said much at all.
Okay. Were you usually the flight leader?
In any flight I was in, I was, because I was, you know, the senior man.
Right.
And, but any of our guys could be in the lead. We'd usually have flights of two or three normally. And that's about it in Vietnam. That was pretty much, you never went off in any great numbers.
Right.
Like in Korea, we would go off with the entire wing mustering on the runway at one time. You may have, 40, 50 airplanes. And then you go off in these big gaggles, look like geese, you know. And but in Vietnam, because of the nature of the targets and the operation, it would just pop off in flights of two or three all day, going after these various targets.
Did you ever go off alone?
And a single bird?
Yes, sir.
No, I don't believe so. I may have gone off in a single bird to a depot to turn an airplane in, you know. We had a depot over there somewhere in China. And I might go off something like that with no ammunition, just
in China or in Taiwan?
Yeah, Taiwan.
Okay.
And we'd go over there maybe and dump an airplane and then come back by courier.
Right.
So, but other than that, there was never any single type operation.
Where did you learn? Well, I'm sure you learned your bombing tactics and maneuvers, your strafing tactics and maneuvers while you were in flight training.
Very little, you know. That's that's where you're initiated in those things. But it was after you get out of there, especially into the tactical fighter business, that's where you're doing it every day. And we had ranges, say in Europe, the big one was El Watia down there in Tripoli, and then we had one in France, Mm-hmm. And we had also had them in England out in the mud flats. Mm-hmm. And so we were, anytime we had to go live with munitions, we would go to those particular ranges. Mm-hmm. And then in the States, we had the same thing. Out in the Arizona areas and places like that, we had ranges which they use today. Mm-hmm. And so there was always ranges around that we were scheduled for temporary duty every few weeks or months, you know, to go out and do this. So we were always shooting and bombing.
How difficult was it for you to develop these tactics? I guess by the time you were in Vietnam, you were fairly proficient at this.
Sure. Yeah. Like Vietnam, let's see. I came right out of Germany on that one, that ALO position. So I hadn't been... I had been shooting right in there. I was flying T-39s out of Wiesbaden, Germany, which is that little North American six-passenger twin-engine jet.
Mm-hmm.
I flew that just for my flying time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I hadn't done any shooting from the time I took that ALO position in Germany. Probably, would that be a year, 18 months before I ended up shooting in Vietnam. And I was trying to think... when I went to Vietnam, I went to those survival schools,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't have to take any refresher deals. Like a lot of times, say, when I went to Korea, you go to Nellis and do a little shooting real quick
mm-hmm.
to refresh yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Vietnam, I just popped over and went into the airplane and continued to do what we did
mm-hmm.
all our life.
When you were out on a sortie and you were approaching a target, you could see the truck or whatever it was you were going for, the building, the bridge.
Yes.
You could see it in your sights coming up, but and I guess your computers on board helped you target. Is that correct?
Yeah, in the F-100, we didn't have any computing gear. We had the great gun sights and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and it was just a matter of putting the pipper, the thing you aim with,
mm-hmm.
it'd be like the sight on a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
You put that on whatever you're after, and whether depending on what ammunition, like strafing with the 420mm cannons, you just like any gun, you just put that pepper on what you're after and,
mm-hmm.
and shoot. And when you bombed, of course, you had to figure winds and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and you'd put that pepper. Depending on your angle of dive and everything, you'd put that pepper at a certain point where you would gain the maximum coverage of the target with a bomb or
right.
a rocket or napalm or whatever you had.
Right. How did you gauge the winds? Was that done?
Yeah, the weather people used to brief us, and we had displays on the walls, every so many hours,
mm-hmm.
showing the winds and the weather and things like that, and
mm-hmm.
we just watch that. And sometimes, if there's any smoke, you could gauge it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we just I remember one time the weatherman gave us a wind from a certain direction and speed, and
mm-hmm.
we had a target, a couple of buildings, I think it was, and I'd go in at my 30-degree angle, probably doing about 500 knots,
mm-hmm.
and put the pepper right where I'd wind it, and went ahead and pitched the bomb. I'd pop them off one at a time,
mm-hmm.
and you could see the bomb go, just like a football, and you could watch it. And,
right.
And it hit way short by, probably 100 yards or so, and I thought, geez, that's really bad. So I'd... swung around, put the pepper up a little higher, and pitched again, and
mm-hmm.
watched the bomb go, and same thing. And I came back, and we checking the weather and the winds and everything. And in that case, we were given a bad windage. And but that's the only time I remember that that affected it that much.
Mm-hmm. You could actually see the bombs hit.
Oh yes. Uh huh.
Okay. So when you pitched it, the bomb would go out kind of in front of you? Or?
Yes. You're coming down maybe, in my case, there are 30 degrees, 500 knots, and maybe a mile or so from the target as you released it, maybe a little more, a couple of miles. And the bomb would just, if you had continued to hold that heading, the bomb would have gone right along with you, dropping as it went, you know. But, of course, you're coming down, too, at that angle. And but we'd usually pitch over to one side and bank, drop the wing so you could see better.
Right.
And then you could see it going. It looked like a peanut or a football, you know. And it'd disappear into the growth and then that'd become a big mushroom. In Korea, I'd seen deals like that where I'd pitch a 1,000-pounder and the same type, same kind of a glide or a power-on approach coming downhill, and you'd see them hit, go in the ground, and then come back up.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They'd go in a little bit, you know, and come up, and then finally blow as the fuse took effect.
Wow.
But it was really weird to see a 1,000-pound bomb go, like skipping a rock on the water, you know?
Yes, sir. I bet so. How accurate would you say the bombing was that you guys were doing?
Once in a while you'd have a little problem. And sometimes, too, you know, the targets weren't that, weren't that well defined. The FAC would go in with his rocket, and he'd pop a Willie Pete smoke rocket, sends up a white column, and he'd pop that, say, into a kind of a growth area. And it, as it would, you'd see that that smoke coming up, he'd say, "Now that's it." He said, "Just put your bombs right in there."
Okay.
But we, you know, you couldn't see, just like out in the forest somewhere, we couldn't see buildings, we couldn't see people or munitions or anything in many cases. And but we were putting them right in, you know, where they wanted, and then he'd come in with these BD-8s and tell us tell us how many arms or legs he saw.
Right, right.
Yeah.
One of the big debating points that historians and veterans of the war, since the war, has been about strategic bombing and the effectiveness of strategic bombing in ground support and just overall how that affects overall diplomacy and foreign policy. And what is your opinion on that? Do you think strategic bombing makes a big difference in the outcome of a war like Vietnam, where it was kind of semi-conventional at times and a lot of guerrilla warfare most of the time?
Yes. You're talking primarily probably SAC, strategic blanket bombing.
That, and you, I guess you were taking out targets and ground support and things like that.
We were hitting, like I say, normally we would carry 200 to 400 or 500 pounders or 750s, 1,000 maybe, and on the fighters. And so the most we would put out, each fighter could have up to maybe normally two. In a flight of three, then you'd have, what, six, anywhere up to six to a dozen bombs, maybe, compared to a B-52, which came out of there like something else.
And, right, right.
And I think, I remember the SAC business up there in Hanoi was on and off type thing, you know, hit them or don't hit them.
Yes, sir.
And this type of thing. And what was it? But I remember that it must have been terrible, you know, awfully demoralizing for the people up there. Of course, they buried, went in underground and everything, but it had to be a tremendous shock on all those people. And some of our people that were in the POW camp, when they came back, they said that when they had a lot of that strategic bombing up there, that some of the guards used to get kind of nice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like they thought that, gee, this is it, you know, this is the end of it. And it was almost like, gee, you know, you remember me, or I never treated you poorly. And,
right.
And you know, chatting with some of the guys, like it was, you know, any day it was going to be over.
Interesting.
And that's about it, I guess, on that end of it.
Okay. Speaking of the POWs there, what kind of POW training did you have? I know they sent you to survival school. Did they cover what would happen if you were shot down? I know you were operating mainly in the South, but if you fell into enemy hands, what kind of training did you have for that?
Yeah, like I said, when I went over, I went to Spokane, that air base there, and I went through that escape and evasion thing, and that primarily was living off the land.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went to, jumped off, we went to the Philippines first and attended another camp there. And that was, they had a makeshift prison. They had our people who were supposedly the Vietnamese guards.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you a rough time and they do everything but torture you. The only torture you get is where they put you on the ground or get your legs and arms all tied up to where it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of yelling and carrying on and a lot of night work and pouring water down your neck and throat.
Wow.
Stuff like that.
How long did that training last?
That was about a week, and then they put us out in the countryside, like jungle area, and they have little negritos, little colored Philippines, like they're kind of short, little like pygmy type, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they would disperse us, or they'd dump us out, say, in a truck at night, and just say go.
Mm-hmm.
And 30 minutes later, an hour later, they'd turn all these little guys loose.
Okay.
And they'd try to find you. And if they'd find you, each of us carried a chit, a little, like a dog tag.
Mm-hmm.
And when anybody would find you, we'd give them the chit. And then they'd get so much rice for each one of these chits. And so I went off, and it started out just before dark, I guess. And then it ended up the next morning at well into daylight. And I happened to find a little hill-type thing, and all real brushy and full of mice and rats and things like that. And I crawled up in the top of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually sent us out I think it was pairs. And in my case, they sent three of us out. And when the little negritos got one, they usually figure, well, there's one more.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, they got two, so they discontinued searching that spot. So I managed to make it through until daylight, and never got caught.
Okay.
But that was the extent of that. And they tried to give you an idea just what it can be like.
Mm-hmm. How much did you think about that while you were flying?
About POW?
Yes, sir.
I don't recall really thinking about it much at all. If we got knocked down in the South, we'd end up in Hanoi too.
Yes.
If we got that far,
whether
they'd keep us there, or torture you, or kill you in the South, if they didn't, you'd probably end up there somewhere. Which, as you see, when all these people are repatriated, they're all, most of them are officers.
Yes, sir.
They're all pilots. A lot of them for the B-52. But I never really thought of that too much. Never even had, I didn't have the butterflies like I had in Korea.
Okay.
In Korea, I kind of figured up, you know, with all that distance, 600 miles enemy territory and chances of getting knocked down. But I didn't have that problem in my stomach in Vietnam.
Right. Did you ever witness any B-52 strikes from the air or from the ground?
No. You know, I've seen them in around the States when they put on practice things, you know, and flown in a couple during those nuclear airborne 24-hour jobs. But other than that, never really saw anything firsthand.
Okay. How much bombing did you do, if any, on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos and or in Cambodia?
Yeah, I'm not sure just where we were, but when we were pulling it, we had what they called I think a night spot.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my memoirs. The fighters would go up at night, and we had a commitment in our wing to where I think it was a couple of weeks or whatever it was, one squadron would get that night duty, and then there'd be a little break, and then another squadron. So this, our time came up, and the subject came up of one squadron taking the whole wing night bombing deal within one squadron to relieve the other squadrons. And that we would just take it for, let's say, a month. I think it turned out to be 28 days. What we would do is we'd go off every few minutes with a flight of three carrying 500-pounders. I think it was two apiece. And we'd go up to 20,000. And the SAC radar people on ground would control us. And, of course, it's pitch dark, and we're up there at 20,000. You can't see anything. And we had a little, what they call a rosette, a little gauge in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. And it would show fly right, fly left, 1 degree, 2 degrees, mm-hmm. and so on. And the SAC guys are talking to you, and they would say, you're 20 seconds from drop. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there tucked in together in a flight of three, and then we'd get kind of a countdown on that gauge, and when it said bombs away, we'd just hit the button.
Hmm.
And then we'd come back and land. And that went on like that all night, mm-hmm. for about a month. And I heard that we were over the Ho Chi Minh and other areas,
mm-hmm.
trying to cut the supply line.
Right, right. How effective do you think the bombing on the Ho Chi Minh Trail was overall for the United States?
I think it had to be with the amount of, see, the 52s, I think, were involved in that.
Yes,
lot.
Sir. Yes,
and,
sir.
I think it had to be pretty effective. Because, God, you know, you just don't, the people on the ground just don't know when that stuff's coming down.
Right.
And then, of course, a lot of them have delayed fuses, mm-hmm. anywhere up to maybe a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can pop off any time. So mm-hmm. when they get the coolies in there to try to recover the trail, these things just pop up and blow up any time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be terribly demoralizing.
It's got to be very disconcerting, I would imagine. Did you ever have any contact with Arvin or the indigenous forces in South Vietnam?
No, I didn't. They were around, but we didn't do any coordinating. The only thing I would know is whatever they would want as far as coverage from the fighters,
mm-hmm.
that went up through the system to Tansanut, mm-hmm. along with our guys, so we could be, you know, we could be covering them too and not know it, or they may tell us, you know, you're going to be bombing some of the Arvin
right.
targets and so on. But actually, talking with them and that type of thing, no, not at all.
Okay, you said that you followed or provided cover for some of the defoliant spraying.
Right.
Did you ever have any contact with the actual defoliant, with the Agent Orange or anything else that you're aware of?
No, we would. You mean get it in the cockpit?
Yes, sir. Any time.
No, we always, there wasn't any big deal over there at that time,
mm-hmm.
Regarding possible sickness, you know,
mm-hmm.
from this thing. But we were up high enough to, we never did get down unless we had to go down and shoot up something, but we never did.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see these multi aircraft right on the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Shooting along there with this big cloud coming out behind them.
Mm-hmm.
But we were sitting off to the side a little bit and, 2,000 or 3,000 feet above them just watching.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never got in any of that spray at all. The only time we'd get into something like that would be some of the birds, the fighters,
mm-hmm.
especially the, I'm trying to think of the, whatever, a little twin engine
mm-hmm.
job that was assigned on our base,
mm-hmm.
and they carried tear gas.
Okay.
And we'd be out marshaling on the taxiway to take off in our birds, and
mm-hmm.
these guys would come up, and once in a while they'd drop a, they carried these things by the dozens in each airplane. Once in a while one would drop off the wing and
mm-hmm.
kick off, and you'd have to go on 100% oxygen because it would, cloud would go through your airplane while you're sitting there.
Right.
And of course, it's, burns your eyes and skin, and That's the only time I ever inhaled anything like that.
Okay. Did you have any other R&Rs? You said you went to the States to see Jody once, and you went to Australia once. Did you take any other R&Rs to your tour?
No, that was about it. I went to Australia, saw my wife from there, and I went home. And then going in Taiwan or something like that once in a while, but that was just out and back, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's kind of strange. Gotta wait a second.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, when you're over in a situation like that, no matter where, combat, wherever it is, and the R&Rs and things like that just don't mean too much, because they're you can get kind of bored, and and then you miss what you've been doing, and the excitement and everything, and you kind of can't wait to get back. And
right.
You'd rather be back in the thick of things than sitting over somewhere, say in Hong Kong or somewhere, you know, relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
was that the mood basically of a lot of the men you served with there?
I kind of think so, whether they'd say anything or not. I don't know what I mentioned in your thing there. We had one squadron commander there, had his wife over, and she was in Bangkok and had a nice apartment, looked just like the States. And he could get away occasionally, he would go over for a day or two, and he invited me one time, and I went over and spent a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And they had nice places to eat, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was the only one I knew of that had a wife over in that area.
Okay. How much were you able to keep in contact or keep up to date with news in the United States? That was, you know, did you have a TV in the barracks, or were you able to keep up with what was happening back stateside?
No TVs.
Okay.
Anything like that.
Okay.
I guess it'd be maybe radio thing once in a while, maybe through Stars and Stripes or something. Of course, they had the Stars and Stripes paper.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't hear an awful lot about some of the campus problems, you know, and things like that. Especially to the degree that it developed in the States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did those anti-war protests affect you guys back over in Vietnam?
I don't really know or feel any effect as far as myself and my troops were concerned. We just have, you know, 24 hours a day, and busy getting the little sleep that we could get, things like that. And we're always meeting schedules and always watching for, you know, ground attacks, rocket attacks, things. So what was happening in the outside world really didn't mean an awful lot to it.
Okay. Were you able to ever attend any USO shows?
No. I never did. That was funny. Including Korea and Vietnam, never saw a show. Jack Benny walked into our mess in Korea one night or one afternoon after he had a show somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two of us sitting there. We came in on a late mission and popped in the mess hall to eat, old Quonset Hut. And Benny walked in with three or four of his people, and he just said, "Hi, guys."
Mm-hmm.
And sat down and ate, and that was it.
Wow.
In Vietnam, once in a while, an actor, like Congressman Kennedy there, he popped through, and just a fleeting thing, and then this one guy, he played, Daniel Boone or something in the TV series.
Fess Parker, was that his name?
I think it was another.
Okay.
another, and he, I recognized him as who he was. And
mm-hmm.
He came out to the alert pad while we were there and chatted a little bit. Mm-hmm. Looked a little uncomfortable. And
he looked a little uncomfortable?
Yeah. He just, well, they usually come in with some kind of a jump shoes and fatigue type uniform,
mm-hmm.
you know. And of course, it's hot and humid over there. And he sat around with some of the young pilots who were chatting with him and getting his signature for their kids and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. But other than that, that's about the extent of my shows.
Okay. Sir, let me pause it just for a second. I'm almost out of time on this disc.
Okay.
Okay. You describe in your memoirs a little bit of life on the base there, Benoit. Could you describe that? What was it like there every day?
Yeah. Okay. When I first arrived
mm-hmm.
and met the DO and everybody, then they kind of just tell you, you know, you got some quarters over there and you got
mm-hmm.
something over here, and they just, in my case, they kind of let you go and take a look.
Mm-hmm.
And the quarters were these rectangular-shaped tent areas. It, like I mentioned, it's a lot like the Boy Scout camps or
mm-hmm.
something. They have a wooden floor.
Okay.
And they have the canvas sides maybe halfway up. And then from halfway point to the top
mm-hmm.
are mosquito, what do you call it, mosquito type.
Mosquito netting?
Yeah. It was actually mosquito screening.
Okay.
And then the roof with either canvas or maybe a hard top,
mm-hmm.
Wooden top with a little tar paper on it or something. And they would probably house, each one would house maybe 4 to 6 pilots or the bunks and mosquito nets and things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the where you lived. And then, of course, as time passed and you got a position like me where I got a squadron, then I ended up in a trailer,
mm-hmm.
kind of a small trailer or maybe part of a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was okay, where you had just a bed and a lamp and a little head and a place to wash and shave and things like that,
mm-hmm.
but very small. And we had a mess hall that I can't remember too much about, and we had a club,
okay.
officer's club, and that wasn't too bad. Again, a field type of sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And there I remember they'd have occasionally a singer or somebody come through, and that the gal who was in the accident, who lost, they said she lost her head.
Yes, sir.
What was that? Yeah, she went
through. I remember, I can't think of the name off right now.
Yeah, she went through one time, but I don't remember much about the club because I was always busy. And,
right.
Maybe go over and have a Coke or something once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember we had a guy, William something, he was a full bird here in Homestead
mm-hmm.
at the 31st Wing during the Cuban thing when I was a major
mm-hmm.
in charge of the command post. And he was kind of a funny little guy, about 5'5",
mm-hmm.
little bit, kind of a belly on him.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a picture on the bulletin board there at the club with him sitting there and this big gal, the big blonde, well-endowed, there sitting on his lap. Both of them with a big grin, you know.
Uh-huh.
So evidently she had gone through.
Okay.
And that was about it as far as that type of thing. And
mm-hmm.
The rest of the thing was, I think we had a little dinky PX of some kind where you got your shaving materials and things like that and by the Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had maybe 4 or 5 barber chairs
mm-hmm.
where the local guys that trimmed you.
Mm-hmm.
And they're primarily with non-electrical, they had shears, scissors and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they had a scissors with the long long handles where they would hold one handle in the left hand and take the other handle and then they'd shear you like you cut hedges, you know?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, but it was really kind of strange there. In Saigon, they had a bigger PX. It took 15 minutes, I guess, to drive into that PX, and
mm-hmm.
I'd go in there and add a little more. And but around the base, the rest of the things were just hangars, usually small, like, nose hanger type thing. Mm-hmm. Wasn't any of the tremendous deals that, like, you have here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the billets around where the troops lived also.
Mm-hmm.
And supply warehouse, things of that nature. And a few, I guess, administrative type things. But
mm-hmm.
very... not an awful lot to anything. Nothing that really stood up. It just kind of, like everything, kind of sheared off.
Mm-hmm.
One or two heights, you know, floors,
yes, uh-huh.
And that was about it. And then, of course, around the strip, you had potholes from rockets and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of construction people, these civilian contract type,
mm-hmm.
filling holes, repairing taxiways and things like that.
These were civilian contractors from the United States.
Yes. And there was usually out there in the various areas, islands or whatever, there's certain people, certain big construction firms, and you'll see the name, you know, like Wagon Hut or whoever it might be, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see that name all through the area,
okay.
So which means that he's got that whole contract.
Mm-hmm.
For everything.
Okay.
And you see that no matter whether it's Guam, Philippines, or where. And of course, they're different people,
mm-hmm.
different big construction people.
Mm-hmm.
But they're working almost daily.
Okay. Did you guys have any pets on base?
We had the big snake.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, there was a few dogs around.
Mm-hmm.
I really like dogs, pets.
Mm-hmm.
We got a little Yorkie here.
Mm-hmm. I saw the picture you attached.
Oh, did you?
Yes, sir.
But the military police, when they get a bunch of the, they call them just cur dogs that run around, that are ill-kept, terrible looking,
mm-hmm.
can't really maybe even pet them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to the point where they get on the runway,
mm-hmm.
and they can become a nuisance there. So that MPs that go around in a truck and maybe shoot them with
mm-hmm.
a shotgun, you know,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Ramrod the snake, and
mm-hmm.
He was about 10 foot long. Good-looking python. And before I took the squadron, I knew they had this snake. Our squadron name was Ramrod.
Right.
So they named the snake Ramrod and
okay.
kept him in primarily in our operations shack, which is... would house a bunch of one floor plan, enough space for guys just to mill around, like briefing room
mm-hmm.
type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we just left the snake in there, and he'd go wherever he wanted to go.
Now, where did they acquire the snake?
Oh, they're all over the ground out there.
Did you see a lot of them out there?
I saw a few, but not being Army type,
right.
They saw all kinds. And
mm-hmm.
We had Ramrod there, and of course he was a big draw.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime we'd have visitors come in, the senior type, the Air Force commander and all of them come by, and geez, they'd sit and look at that big guy curled up in the corner, you know.
Uh-huh. He had the free reign of the building?
Yeah, he just went wherever he wanted to go. And we had a cage out beside the building
uh-huh.
that had chicken wire to enclose it. And
mm-hmm.
One of the airmen put him in there for a while. I don't know if someone was coming by or what, but he was in the shade. But eventually it moved around to the point where the sun hit it,
mm-hmm.
and he died of a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And so we buried him in a 10-foot pipe. And they had all the fanfare, and Stars and Stripes got pictures and spread in the paper.
Oh, yeah.
But when we lost him, the Army guys around the perimeter heard. And, of course, they read it, the Stars and Stripes there.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought one over. Well, they brought many over. And they'd catch them in a big these big garbage, just 20-gallon things.
Mm-hmm.
And Ramrod was a beautiful, phosphorescent, green, beautifully marked guy.
Mm-hmm.
And never bothered anybody. He struck one of our pilots once because he was molting, and it also affects the cover on their eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that the snake just looked up and saw this guy, and they opened that mouth, and it just, oh, I guess, hundreds of teeth, mm-hmm. little bitty needles, and he just bang and hit that guy in the arm, and it brought a bunch of little beads of blood, you know, mm-hmm. and it really shocked that guy because
I'm sure.
Cause he used to kiss him and hug him, and he thought that was the greatest snake, and from that point on, he kind of didn't like him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Army troops found out this out, every once in a while, we'd end up with a big 20-gallon bucket mm-hmm. under operations, and we'd open up, and here's a tremendous snake in there. And mm-hmm. in one case, it was probably, I'd say, maybe 18 feet long.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
Big around your thigh, and
oh, gosh.
Dark. You uh-huh. didn't have that beautiful green glowing color mm-hmm. because he probably lived in the growth out there,
mm-hmm.
and because of that, he was almost black, and he had a terrible disposition.
Mm-hmm.
So we peddled around with him a little bit and realized that this wasn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So we put him out beside this, our ops office in mm-hmm. the grass in a little Korean or Vietnamese papasan who kind of helped around the area.
Mm-hmm.
Saw this. And, gee, he reached over and he grabbed this guy by the tail and was trying to pull him back. And
back on the base?
Yeah, it was right there beside our operations office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that little papasan, I think, worked for us.
Okay.
And so he grabbed this snake by the tail, and as he would pull him back, the snake would horseshoe back
mm-hmm.
like it was going to bite him, and mm-hmm. he'd let him go again. And he kept that up for a bit. And finally we said, well, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with that big snake? And he said, feed the baby.
Oh, boy.
Feed the family, you know.
Right.
So then we went off flying or something. So I don't think he ever got him because he was a little spooked
uh-huh.
because it was such a big snake. But they came in. Snakes were just every day or so were getting another one from these
mm-hmm.
Army guys. And
mm-hmm.
It finally kind of dwindled out. I guess they thought we had enough there after a while.
Mm-hmm.
But we never... Never kept one in at any length after Ramrod died. But when we were going to take the squadron, McLaughlin, Colonel McLaughlin,
mm-hmm.
he retired as a two-star. He said, you can get rid of that snake, aren't you? You know, when you take over that 531st.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, sir, you know, I'll get rid of him. And as soon as I took over, Jesus, I realized that the guys looked at that snake like you would look at your little dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't about to get rid of it. So
right.
I just told him, no way. So this wing commander used to get a bang out of, he'd had his staff car,
mm-hmm.
like a squad car, and he'd say, put that snake in the back, in the back seat.
Uh-huh.
And we had an Oriental full bird who was our wing maintenance officer,
mm-hmm.
and scared to death snake.
Uh-huh.
So I'd put the snake in the back seat, and old McLaughlin would go pick up this full bird Oriental
uh-huh.
extraction and put him in the front seat.
Mm-hmm.
He'd put his arm up on the back of the seat here,
mm-hmm.
the front seat, and they'd ride along, and all of a sudden he'd see that snake, and my God, he'd bail out of that car. But that's the type of fun they had with him.
And mm-hmm.
Any time we'd brief anybody, when they'd come in, the visiting fireman type, he'd be up maybe behind me,
mm-hmm.
Up against the wall, or just all coiled up.
Really?
And these guys would be listening to you, but their eyes sticking out, watching that big snake. And, of course, he wouldn't move. He'd just sit there.
Uh-huh.
And they'd go forever without eating anything, and they'd usually end up eating mice and rats. Things like that.
Would you guys feed Ramrod?
Yeah, if we ever found a bunch of mice or rats,
uh-huh.
we'd just put them in his cage, and he'd go around picking them up.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay.
But that was about it as far as pets.
That's a pretty memorable pet.
Yeah.
I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So for entertainment, you had, I guess, Ramrod. You had the Officers Club
uh-huh.
There. Were you in charge of allowing your men under you to go on R&Rs, or was that someone else's call?
I didn't, I don't recall signing anything,
mm-hmm.
any R&Rs, but they had, I think they could go off, occasionally, usually in a situation like that,
mm-hmm.
they sometimes will have a courier,
mm-hmm.
in Korea, it was a C-47 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. And that used to go to Shanghai and places, and we'd jump on that once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure at Benoit there, of course, Saigon was a pretty fine town, you know, for the troops. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you had to be real careful because you could be hand grenaded or stabbed or mm-hmm. things like that without even knowing it, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I was trying to think if I imagine there's an occasional deal, maybe they go to Taiwan or somewhere in a mm-hmm. in a courier. But I was tied up primarily with my guys and my pilots. And of course, I had about 300 troops. But they were also tied in with the overall general maintenance, which this full bird Oriental type oversaw mm-hmm. these guys. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he had an adjutant, administrative section, things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and we had real top zebras, you know, the big senior NCOs with all the stripes. Mm-hmm. And they would take care of anything. And I remember me talk to my troops mm-hmm. and tell them, like you always tell them, the door is always open. Mm-hmm. You know, my door, if you mm-hmm. want to come in and bring up something, you do it. And they'd all sit there smiling and nodding their heads, you know, fine, outstanding. Mm-hmm. And then when I'd walk out, these zebras that real discreetly, you know, say, if I ever catch one of you guys, you know, knocking on his door, you know, you're dead.
Right.
So they took care of all of that.
Right.
But once in a while we'd have a little stakeout right there in the ground or around the ops type where they'd crack a 55-gallon drum and charcoals and mm-hmm. and they had steaks and cokes and mm-hmm. things like that. And then you'd sit around and chat with the guys.
Right. Did you feel like you had a good rapport with the men under you?
Yes.
Did you ever encounter any racial issues while there?
Not a bit. Don't recall a thing. The only thing that I can remember, and it's not racial, was I had a little guy that came out of, Father Flanagan's place?
Mm-hmm.
What's that, Boys Town?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yes, sir.
Yeah, a nice-looking little guy. Mm-hmm. About, 5'6", something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just pleasant as could be, and he was a real terror. He just got into everything. He had all kinds of fake ID cards, and he'd go to town and try to sell things from the PXs and things like that. And that's the only guy I can really remember. And he just got so bad that when I left, I told the and I'd talk with him, and God, he's so, I found so sincere and so good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to get off this business of all this getting in trouble. And
mm-hmm.
So some lieutenant colonel took over, and I told him, I said, the only problem I know of in the squadron is this little guy. And mm-hmm. I said, but I think he's squared away. You know, I said, boy, he's really been great
mm-hmm.
for the last whole month or so. And just before I went home, this guy, the squadron commander came up to me and he said, you remember that kid you're telling me about?
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah. And then he went off and said, oh, God, he got caught. And he, had all these ID things. He'd been selling things mm-hmm. to the natives and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And finally, what was it? He cut his wrists.
Oh, really?
He cut his wrists. And so that in that he got in so deep under so many areas
mm-hmm.
that he pulled that insanity thing, and
mm-hmm.
and so they immediately just put him through the medical system,
mm-hmm.
and I guess he said, and that's that guy you said was real great, so I guess they probably end up sending him home.
Right.
But that's the only kind of a weird thing I can think of.
What ethnicity was he?
Just a little Caucasian guy.
Okay. All right. What was the bravest action that you witnessed while in Vietnam?
Bravest?
Yes, sir.
I again, I can't, considering all the guys and everything, mm-hmm. I can't think of anything other than they're scared to death, a lot of them, mm-hmm. For a while or every night with these rockets going off. And mm-hmm. every time the rockets go off, everybody dives into the bunkers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I run over to our troops, to their barracks, and they would all be, say, 200-300 of them, all in a big clump in,
mm-hmm.
in the center of the barracks and on the floor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest would be in bunkers where they were available.
Mm-hmm.
And that would go on for maybe an hour until the rockets were all cleared. And then they would come out, but I don't know of any flight or anything where someone was congressional or
mm-hmm.
Silver Star type thing. Although there's some Silver Stars coming out for
mm-hmm.
heroism, bravery. But God, I've a couple of accidents there that I've had in my. Maybe you have it there with the
mm-hmm.
the man was buried in the cockpit.
Yeah, I was reading about that. I was going to ask you, do you have any memorable events with the birds there? And those came to mind.
Yeah, that was one where it was really hectic for after being buried underwater in that cockpit for almost an hour. He came out alive because he was sucking oxygen through the system.
Can you describe that event?
Yeah, I've got that in my memoirs.
Yes,
but,
sir.
I don't know how much I gave you, but this guy is a captain from
mm-hmm.
a base north of us.
Mm-hmm.
He's flying an F. Had a young enlisted man in the back seat,
mm-hmm.
photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're over just west of us somewhere, and he got hit, and it affected the fuel system where he started losing fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So he immediately declared emergency and headed to our place. It's at the closest base, and Tonsadu, of course, is right just a couple of minutes from us.
Mm-hmm.
But we were a hot fighter base, so he headed to us. He had a wingman, I think. Wingman went in at Tonsadu,
mm-hmm.
okay, just to get out of the way. And this guy set up on the final approach, and I imagine the fuel gauge is really going down, and
mm-hmm.
he lined up on the runway, and we didn't have any real activity at that point as far as landings and takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
And he, being in a mayday situation, he was all set. So he set up a final approach a little high
mm-hmm.
and a little fast, because if it quit, you wanted to be sure to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked the young troop in the back if he wanted to bail out or stick with it. And the pilot, a captain who retired as a major general,
mm-hmm.
He said that he was going to stick with it.
Okay.
And the guy, he said that the young airman said, I'm with you.
Okay.
So they come in, and he was long, what we say, long and hot,
mm-hmm.
high and hot. And because of a situation like that, you can end up hitting the nose wheel first, which you don't want to do, because
mm-hmm.
it's like a tricycle, and it'll start to porpoise to
okay.
the point where you lose control. And that's what happened. That sheared the nose gear off and left the right side of the runway, probably a third halfway down the runway, and tore the wings up pretty much, and it ended up in this big crater.
Mm-hmm.
And the crater was full of water. It was about the depth of my den here. I'd say six to 9 feet.
And he was upside down.
Right, he was upside down.
Okay.
And then at that point, the aircraft had twisted, like the tail, instead of sticking up vertically behind you,
mm-hmm.
behind your head, it was down on the, you know, point towards the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And there that thing sat in that hole, and old muddy water, you know, bubbling around. So
mm-hmm.
the wing commander at that time had his radio equipped bird,
mm-hmm.
or aircraft, or aircraft. Quad car, so he was listening to everything on the tower, and I was in our squadron jeep reconnoitering the runway again,
mm-hmm.
but I saw what was happening, so I took off over to that spot and got there bubbles are still coming up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Catlin was the name of the colonel at that time, who was the base, the wing commander.
Mm-hmm.
And so he immediately got a dozer where some native was riding it, driving it. And he had the driver couldn't speak English, so the colonel was just, you know, follow me type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he got him over there and tied a cable around the darn fuselage and everything. And at that point, it was still heavy, even though it lost wings and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But it weighed probably 10,000 pounds, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so they tied the cable around it, started pulling and banging away, and it wasn't like pulling it up vertically. They had to kind of drag it, you know,
mm-hmm.
horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
And you just can't do it. The cable snapped. So the colonel took off, found another dozer. So both dozers were over there working at it. In the meantime, I called an army outfit west of us and asked them if they had a super chopper. You know,
mm-hmm.
they had these tremendous weight-carrying choppers.
Mm-hmm.
And if they could, we had a pilot down, upside down, and this thing. And the guy said, well, okay, we'll check it out. But to them, they got so many problems, so many deaths, and so on, that they never did show, so I don't know how much effort they put in. But
mm-hmm.
as they kept working, and then the dang airplane started to burn.
Mm-hmm.
And first, what was left of the gas and oil come up, and it sent these big columns of black smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the dozers and the colonel and everybody had to get back
mm-hmm.
because they didn't know what was going to happen. And then came the white smoke from the burning metal, and then finally the 20-millimeter cannon ammunition started going off,
mm.
and that was popping around the area like crazy.
Mm-hmm. Did you all go for cover?
Yeah, we all just got back away from it so we wouldn't get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so then as things quieted down, we all kind of went back again and checking, and we had a flight surgeon's tent was not too far from there,
mm-hmm.
and so he jumped in the water and went underground, went
mm-hmm.
underwater,
mm-hmm.
and was feeling down around the cockpit. And the cockpit was open just a hair, but the fact it was upside down, the canopy bubble was forced against the ground, the base of that hole,
mm-hmm.
With all this water above it,
mm-hmm.
and which meant the cockpit and everything was flooded. It had been for almost an hour. So the flight surgeon reached in to see what he could find, and he touched the pilot's shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he felt the pilot come up and grab his hand.
Wow.
And so the flight surgeon came out of that hole yelling, you know, he's alive, he's
mm-hmm.
alive.
Mm-hmm.
So then they went crazy. They started again cabling it and trying to pull it just to one side to where they could get it up on the side a little bit where they get that canopy out of the way and get him out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So, which they finally did. And the pilot came out, puckered up like a prune. And but he was okay, and the little airman in the back was killed when they hit.
Mm.
He was dead. And the thing was that the pilot, knowing the bird and everything, he popped his oxygen mask to his face, and it was full of water, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He had it on when he landed.
Mm-hmm.
But he just held it tight to his face and exhaled
mm-hmm.
and blew all that water out around his ears
mm-hmm.
after he'd swallowed a couple and dirty, dusty, murky water,
mm-hmm.
and then he reached down and put his oxygen to 100%, and then you got a self-contained unit in the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you've got, normally you'd have plenty of oxygen if you didn't rupture something
mm-hmm.
in that craft. So he sat there for that hour, inhaling that oxygen.
Wow,
that's what saved him. And they said it wasn't about just full minutes after he was rescued, they said the oxygen was depleted. And they said, had that young enlisted man lived and they both drew on that system, they'd both be dead.
Wow.
So they flight surgeon sat there with the captain for an hour, like you and I here with a tape, and he just bled that whole thing out. And he asked the pilot, he said, did you know you were on fire? He said, no. He said, did you hear the ammunition going off? He said, no. He said, how long do you think you're under there? And he said, about 15 minutes.
Wow.
And he said it was almost an hour.
Wow.
So that was a hectic deal, and the man lived, and then, what, 30-some years, he's retired now as a two-star, living, I think, on the southeast coast here somewhere. I sent him a copy of everything I had, but he didn't answer.
Okay. Do you remember a really careless act with any of the birds?
Careless?
Yes, sir.
I sure can't think of any unless there's something in my my records here. Not there. Everybody's so serious. It wasn't like, you know, when you're younger out dusting off people and buildings and things like that. Because you're doing that every day here, shooting and bombing. And, so that pretty well took care of that. There's one deal. I don't know if you got it there. Where the pilot came back on his last mission, and he didn't have very often. Usually a guy got his last mission, and he was ready to get that thing on the ground and get ready to go home. But he came back, and he was going to overfly the control tower right on the top, you know, right on the treetop. And he come tearing across. I was sitting right near in a Jeep. Actually, I was rolling along. I had a couple of my troops in me. And he come tearing over the control tower at about 500 knots. He just finished probably 250th mission, probably. And the wing came off.
Wow.
And left wing, I think it was. And he was, like I said, he was right at treetop level. And but he was going so fast that without that wing, the airplane just yawed about almost 90 degrees, I guess, and just kept going. And as it was going, it was shedding everything. It was raining pieces, and we were kind of ducking, you know, as the stuff came down. And at a distance, and I remember one of the guys in my Jeep kept saying, eject, you know, just talking to himself, you know, eject, eject, eject. And it got to about a mile, and then it started to fall vertically. And at that point, he ejected. Just as he kind of went below the tree level, and the seat came up out of the mess, but he was dropping at about the same speed that seat was going up, so he just kind of pooped out and fell back into the wreck and died. And
wow.
The wing came off and killed one American troop, enlisted man, and the body of the airplane killed a few Vietnamese. But that was a situation where I told my troops, boy, don't ever do something like that after a mission without, you want to always land and have the airplane looked at, because if you have any kind of internal structural damage from munitions shot at you or whatever, you could have a problem. And we didn't know, but he very well could have had some material damage in that airplane, that which caused the wing to come off. Because 500 knots in that airplane under rough air isn't anything at all.
Right.
But that's...
Why didn't he eject any sooner than that?
Just too busy, I think. And probably when he's yawn like that, you're slammed up against the side of the cockpit, you know. And you have to pull up your armrests. They blow the canopy. And then the triggers are exposed, and you pop those, and it shoots your seat. If the canopy for some reason fails, it'll blow you. It'll blow you through the canopy.
Right.
And everything would be cool, but it didn't work.
Sir, what were your impressions of the Vietnamese civilians that you had contact with?
Civilians?
Yes, sir.
I thought they're nice little people. We had within our squadron, we probably had down in the ops line, ops building, on the flight line, we had probably four or five little guys, and one little gal. We had a little snack bar. We had served Coke and and I think candy bars, maybe some kind of little sandwiches or something, I don't know. But we had that, two people, and one little grandma-san, mama-san, probably 50s, in her 50s. And they'd sneak Cokes and things home, you know. I'd give them Cokes. I remember the little, I'd hand them a couple of Cokes, tell them to go ahead and take them home. And the little girl who was kind of the English speaker of the bunch, she said, you know, they take Cokes all the time. And I said, well, that's okay. Because they, I guess, she said something about they cost a couple of dollars downtown or something. So they were fine. And then, of course, we'd go to, once in a while I'd go to the PX, which was that 15-minute drive east and south to Saigon. And, of course, you'd have people all over the place, kids, little children and whatever. And they always seemed like little, you know, fine people. Never saw any nastiness from them, but used to hear about how they'd ride through Saigon on a little motor scooter, some guy with his girl on the back, girlfriend, and in her little silk kimono type thing, you know, and she'd maybe pop somebody in the street corner, some military, that type of thing was fairly common. And then the time I got caught in this shootout going into Saigon, I think that, I don't know if that's in what information you have yet or not, but I was, just before I left for home, I took our staff car and we're going to drive 15 minutes into the CX, look around a little bit, and then 15 minutes back, and probably been 45 minutes round trip. And as I approached Long Bin, which is an Army unit directly east of us, just 2 minutes.
Right.
And with a, there's also a hospital there, Benoit, or the hospital and post, and the traffic kind of tightened up. And I thought, gee, I'm not going to make it to that, the main north-south double-lane asphalt that goes into the city. So I backed off a little bit, turned down into the brush, and got onto a back route. And I didn't get any distance there, and I got in the same thing. And then I could hear the gunfire up in front of me and bullets zipping through the trees, you know. So by that time, my God, I was swamped. I was in a, like you see in the movies, I was in a hundreds of little Vietnamese people with the stuff on their head and their kids and their animals and whatever, mostly on foot. And they had this little old dirt road just packed. And I finally realized that, especially when the bullets started zipping through there too, that I wasn't going to be able to go any further there. So I finally piddled around, and at that point I had hundreds of these people around me. And I wondered, you know, if someone might stick me or shoot me or something. But I had my .38 in my shoulder holster, which we always carried, and wasn't any problem. I ground the windows up on the squad car so they wouldn't flip something in there.
Right.
And most of the vehicles had bars and heavy screens, like the buses, little, you know, duty buses and things that we had. They were all so secure that they couldn't possibly throw anything in. But this squad car was just a standard squad car with the windows that would go down, and there's no screening, so I'd pop those up. Finally effed around a little bit, and 8 hours later, I made it back to the base.
8 hours?
8 hours instead of 45 minutes.
Right. So nothing happened to you at all? You just had a long journey?
Yeah. I kissed the ground a little bit when I got back.
And that's right before you were leaving the country?
Yeah. I left probably a couple of days, and I thought, you know, geez, this can be tough. If I lose the staff car, old Bob Corey's going to be, you know, disturbed with me. But I finally got back and told him about it.
They give you a hard time?
No.
No. Okay. What did they tease you?
Did
they tease you about it?
No. I think he was the only one that I told the story, too, right there. Mm-hmm. So he, I'm sure, told McLaughlin all of them, but, mm-hmm. but I left so soon that I never heard anything.
Right. Sir, looking back at your Vietnam experience, is there anything you would change about it, if you could?
No. Can't think of anything. It's all quite an experience, and it's just part of your 30 years. And it's interesting. No matter where you go or what combat theater or whatever, things are similar a little bit, but... it's, well, I don't know if you call it pleasant. I was always pretty comfortable. Of course, you miss your wife. Stuff like that.
Right.
But I can't think of any changes.
Okay.
I'm just glad that I didn't get shot down.
Yeah, you flew 156 combat missions.
Right. I would have, like I mentioned, I would have flown probably 250, which is about the average, but. And I, but I briefed for 250, but as a squadron commander, I would, for the balance of those missions, I would be called by the wing commander or some higher authority to do something. And I couldn't say, well, stand by or I'll call you back. I had to drop everything. So I always had a man, a pilot, brief with me. And when I was preempted for something else, he would get the mission. So I ended up briefing for 150, flew 156. We had one young lieutenant, Air Force Academy graduate, first lieutenant. He flew 250. He was the one that lost oil pressure and bailed out, and they picked him up in a chopper. He's probably about 24, maybe. And of course, he, like some, there's a few, you know, that he wanted to really get the experience. So he signed up for another year, and he totaled 500 missions.
Wow.
With one bailout. And so he was very fortunate because some go down on the first and some go down on the last.
Right, right. From Vietnam, you went to Maxwell Air Force Base.
Right. I was selected to go to Air War College and at Maxwell. And so I checked in there in May of 68, and it's about a college year. I think I was in school 10 months, something like that, and didn't have to fly because you just don't have that time. But when you get up to that point, they still allow you your flying pay without flying.
Okay.
So that was great.
Right. You went basically, I mean, how much of a transition was it from Vietnam to Maxwell? I mean, you'd made so many moves and transitions in your life, but coming out of this war zone, how was that for you?
Yeah, no problem. I flew a commercial jet up out of Tantanu to the West Coast, I think it was, probably jumped a regular commercial run to Miami and picked up Jody, and we... see, we drove right up to Maxwell, or whatever few days I may have had between the assignment, and picked up an apartment in town in Montgomery, and wasn't any problem, just another move.
When you were on the flight, after you got off the flight back stateside and you flew to Miami, were you in uniform then?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have any negative reception anywhere along that route?
Not a bit.
Okay.
I made full bird just before I left Vietnam.
Right, right.
And, that's it, the most shocking to me, or anything regarding an anti-war thing, was even now, once in a while they show the, some of this Tampa stuff, you know, and I thought, my God, was it that... detail, you know, that many people concerned, and no one threw anything, no one said anything. It was just to me, it was just like another assignment in the States.
Right, right.
Beautiful. I stayed there for that almost a year. That was a nice school. had an awful lot of great speakers, mm-hmm. everything up short of the president, and DOD guys, top Air Force generals in command of the various FACs, TACs, MACs, all those places, all kinds of top civilian speakers, and that speaking program, that was fabulous. It was almost a speaker a day, and then pulling all kinds of war games and things like that, and working military budgets and things like they do every day.
Mm-hmm. How much did you follow Vietnam, the war and American policy, once you'd gotten back stateside?
Follow it how?
Well, just follow it in the news, what the United States was doing in country. And
I didn't really watch it too. I'd see it on telly, and again, for that, in the war college there, I was really, really up to it again. You're really in deep, and I think we had a TV in the apartment. I'm not sure, but I was studying so much. I usually go in a den, close the door, and start working. And I kind of wonder, you know, and then I heard this business, how we were going to move out, and the Arvind is going to take over and win that thing. And at that point, I said, we're finished. If we move out of there, the communists will move right in.
Right.
And they did. So that, right there, I when I heard that, and then Westmoreland and the bunch, I think, you know, surely felt the same way.
Do you remember how you felt in April 1975 when Saigon fell?
I kind of felt it was inevitable, so it wasn't any great shock. And so I saw some of that on telly with the embassy and the choppers and things like that, and so many of the natives trying to get out of there, too, and get to the States. But that was a sad deal. But like I say, when they started talking about us leaving and the locals taking over, I thought, well, it'll be days and it'll be over. So it wasn't any big surprise.
Just a matter of time.
Yes.
Okay. What is your perception of Vietnam today?
What little I see, seems like they're fabulous, you know, the way they've come out of that terrible tearing up of their country. I don't know how their problems are politically and that type of thing, but it's with all that terrible bombing and stuff like that, and you see pictures of congressmen and groups from schools and colleges over there, and they're all walking around like it was Disney World, you know, and it's like, gee, it's kind of hard to believe that. And it, of course, the time to me has really passed fast. It's been 30 years since I retired, and it seems like a month. It just, time's gone so fast, I just can't. I've been retired as long as I was in the military.
Right. And, I guess you have.
Yeah. And, but 30 years on their own, my God, it's, see pictures of the cities, Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh now, and it's kind of hard to believe that they're getting along so great.
Right. How many, or how much contact have you had with Vietnamese here in the United States, if any?
Not a bit.
Not a bit, okay. Looking back at your when you're over there, are there any songs or anything like that remind you, that take you back to that time period when you're at Binh Hoa?
No, not a bit that I can think of.
Okay. What about books on Vietnam? What would you consider some of the better books, if you know of any, that chronicle the war or parts of it?
I'm kind of lazy. I haven't read anything at all.
Okay.
It's all very interesting what I see. I see a lot of the stories on TV, factual things, you know, not Hollywood stuff, but things like that. I'm really interested in that, but I'm just not much. I get kind of antsy or bored. I got to kind of keep moving or things got kind of faster on me. Sit and bury in a book just is kind of rough for me. I had a book or so here written by a Frenchman who I gave him some information for. He had a coverage of Vietnam with all of our organizations over there, but it's all in French. it's a good sized book, probably 300-400 pages. Mm-hmm. And I ended up, like someone like you contacted me,
mm-hmm.
and I sent him the book. I don't speak French or read French,
right?
And but my name and pictures and stuff were through there,
mm-hmm.
so I just sent it to this man who I think he was looking for information on his father's
mm-hmm.
Experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have that book.
Okay. Have you seen any of the movies that have come out on Vietnam?
Yes, I've seen a few.
What do you think of those?
Kind of bloodthirsty. I don't know how true to life. I don't recall any of them by name. Some of them I don't stick with too long.
Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons do you think the United States government learned, if any, in Vietnam?
One thing, it's a heck of a lot bigger, broader situation than a lot of us thought.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, looking at it's a little Iraq today,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think people are thinking back of Vietnam and
mm-hmm.
say, geez, you know, we started out and we had so many hundreds of thousands of troops, and Westmoreland was indicating rightfully that, you know, we were doing well, and
mm-hmm.
But we could use a few more and things like that. And then
mm-hmm.
a lot of people said he was lying
mm-hmm.
and hiding the facts and all that, which I don't think he was. It's just the situation. And Hussein over there, that situation, his country might be a similar type thing as Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a lot of our guys felt, too, that, you know, we lost so many people over there
mm-hmm.
that try and shame, and they still end up, they're communists.
Right.
Only the whole country now.
Right, right.
So I don't know if you call it a mistake or not. And
mm-hmm.
like I say, in my situation, and it's just kind of selfish, you know, you got all these fighter guys and the wings, they're ready to go, and
mm-hmm.
all you got to do is, like, junkyard dog, you hit them in the right direction and they're off.
Mm-hmm.
And I never just gave it too much thought one way or another, just to get my job done and not end up as a POW.
Right, right. For young people today, if you were to, say, walk into a college classroom or a high school classroom, what would you tell them about Vietnam?
Probably just about what I've been talking with you, I guess,
mm-hmm.
from what I saw. Of course, in my case, it was just kind of localized. You know, I'm sitting there around Benoit Air Base and Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And Saigon, just a couple, three visits.
Right.
And then everything else is just out and back.
Right.
In an aircraft. That's about all I could cover. And some of these people that were in the north, they got some real terrible stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then those, of course, that end up as POWs.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few people that ended up there.
Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
Like now, you know,
mm-hmm.
just look around?
Yes, sir.
We do a lot of traveling through military transportation, you know,
mm-hmm.
air. And we hit Europe, South America, Australia, and these places. Europe maybe every couple of years. Vietnam, Japan, China, those areas, I'm not too eager to see anymore, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Europe and places like that are just more enjoyable,
mm-hmm.
more like home, you know.
Right. Spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, and it's a lot, like you can rent cars and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it's a lot like home.
Right.
We go over, rent a car, and grab a map and just take off.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we've some areas I know about like home.
Right.
But Vietnam, I don't know. Maybe China, the Chinese Wall, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My wife kind of thinks she might, you know, she might like to hit that area. But I tell her it's not quite as easy
mm-hmm.
Renting cars and getting around as it is in Europe.
That's right. Right.
Especially Japan, where you got the islands, and
mm-hmm.
but I just don't have any real to go over in that area right now.
Okay. After Maxwell, you went to Langley for, what, 4 years?
Right.
3.5 years?
Right.
And you had a desk job.
Right.
What made you retire? Was your, you just got your 30 years in?
Or? Yeah, I was getting up there. I was in plans, operations and plans, there in the, again, no fly-in, but got fly-in pay, just like in the college. And Mo Meyer, who was 7th Air Force Commander over there, was also our commander there in the building where I was. And so and I participated in a study or so in, on the future plans and equipment and so on of the Air Force. And as I got some of the toughest work in my 30 years was, you know, working in the studies and things like that. And then got along with everybody. Everybody's fine. And I started getting up there close to retirement. And I got a call from the Pentagon, I think it was, from the colonel's assignment. And they say I'd been selected as an air attaché for Israel.
Okay.
And they asked me how I felt about it. And so I thought, well, let me think about it a little bit. And they said I would have to go to Washington for a year to language school. And then I would go over there for a tour, which was a senior attaché with the ambassador of Israel. And so I thought, well, let me think about it. So I talked to Jody, went home, and I said, how long are you going to give me? And they said, oh, take 2 days, you know. And I said, the fact that there's a policy, if a full colonel is offered a position and he doesn't take it, they retire you.
Oh, really?
Almost immediately.
Okay.
And so I asked them if that policy was in effect. And they said, no, this is a special deal.
Okay.
He said, you think about it, call us back. So I talked to Jody, and at that time, she thought, oh, God, you know, over there and whatever. And so she's a biblical nut. And later on, after it was all over, she said, see, we should have taken that. But I called the guy back and said, no, I think I'll pass it up. And he said, okay. And they don't tell you anything beyond that point on what kind of a future they might have lined up for you or what.
Right.
So I just bowed out and went back to doing the work. And in the meantime, a guy I worked with, another full bird, he went off to out in the west. I'm not sure just what Texas, out in there somewhere. And he took over a wing, a wing commander of a. Of a transport outfit, not a fighter or a bomber, but a transport thing, I believe it was. And so he and I worked together on a study, and we got along fine. And so he started sniffing around. He's going to try to get me and to come out there, and I heard about it. So they started a check on me. You know, they want you, everything about you and so on. You and others, or who's going to be the best man, stuff like that. And I didn't certainly didn't want to go. He had the tactical unit, which would be like a tactical fighter or a strategic bomb thing. And what I would take would be the base. You become a base commander, which is like a custodian, you know, for the whole works. But he is the prima donna. He's the what he says goes. Around that base, and anything he wants, all he does is ask you or tells you, you know. And I've been tactical all my life, and I didn't want to go into that custodial thing. So I hadn't talked to him, but I'd heard all this from someone else. So right away, I thought, geez, I better because that one, if they'd have called me, which you know could be any minute. Then, if I turned it down, they would retire me right there.
Probably, yes, sir.
So I went over to personnel and said, I think I'll retire. And the guy, of course, I don't think he had any inkling that what was going on. He was a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'll set such and such a date. So I set a date up there that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. So I went ahead and he said, we'll put her through. And it wasn't a couple of days. This Claude Turner, who was my buddy out there at the base,
mm-hmm.
called me and said, hey, he says, I got good news for you. And I said, what's that? He said, you're coming out here to take over the base.
Hmm.
And I said, really? I said, did you know that I'm retiring? And he says, what? He says, what's this? And I said, well, I got right up there at 30, and I said, I'm about ready to go, you know,
mm-hmm.
and not indicating that it wasn't my bailiwick, kind of that type of thing. So
mm-hmm.
he said, well, okay. He said, I surely wind out here. And then he wrote me a letter, and a nice long letter, thanked me for everything in the past, and
mm-hmm.
said it probably wouldn't be too long before he'd be joining me.
Mm-hmm.
I understand he's sentry tired and dead. Then I just went ahead and did my thing, and I volunteered for a career or Vietnam again.
Oh, you did?
About that time, because I had, say, a year or so to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the Pentagon, the guys, and I told them, and of course they know, you know, the guys in assignments. I said, you know, you got me on retirement,
mm-hmm.
and I've got a year or so to go. And I said, no problem. I said, I'm sitting here in a desk job. But I said, I could put another year in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy said, no, not when we're, you know, pending retirement, stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. So
mm-hmm.
I pleaded with him and told him that I wasn't trying to get out of the retirement or anything
mm-hmm.
else, because
mm-hmm.
they wondered what hanky-panky may have been going on. So I went on with him for the longest time, and they just finally came back. Said, no, we can't do it. So they called my guy I worked for as a couple of stars, a general there in the next office,
mm-hmm.
and said, hey, this guy Key is trying to pull something. And they said, he said, what's that? He said, oh, he's trying to get back to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
which would extend my 30 years on into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, would you have gotten paid more if you went back into a war zone? Combat pay, or
I think we may have gotten casual. What do you call? Well, I've always got flying pay. I think we got some kind of combat pay or something,
mm-hmm.
but nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And but the old general called me in, and I sit there a minute, chatted with him. He mentioned this, and I said, "Jesus, you know, I told those guys. I said I've got a year or so in, which coincides to a year in Vietnam. I could be over there." Shooting and doing something, you know, rather than sitting here shuffling papers.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on with him for the longest time, and he got all bottom line. He says, I think you're trying to pull something. And I thought, oh, get lost, you know, because
right.
I was serious.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get over there and do something rather than sit around there. And
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, if you ain't going to believe me, forget it. So I just went back. And then he said, if you want to accept that base out there at with Claude Turner,
mm-hmm.
he said, we could scrap that retirement thing. See, as long as it favors the service, you know, they can do anything.
Right.
But if it's something that you want and they don't, then mm-hmm. they're just, it's a concrete wall.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, we'll just tear that up, you know. And I thought, no, I didn't want to do that. But then that business there, the fact that I had gotten the word and everything, that got a little hot, because they wondered, you know, how come he turned that down and stuff like that. And the thing that bugs them is that they put a lot of time and effort into checking you out, you know, for
right.
a position, you
right.
and others. And when it doesn't work out, they get a little angry. And
mm-hmm.
so this general and a couple other people in there got in hot water because I had managed to just work the thing out to where it was to my benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And don't know what happened, but I know that the general was retired and another colonel was retired that were involved in that thing, you know.
Wow.
And whether it had anything to do with that mess there, and I was still gone. So they were, and they were all giving me, oh, gee, I feel sorry for you leaving and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a year later, I was going, and they were out. So it was kind of a strange setup. But then another friend of mine called me and said, how'd you work that? You know, he said he was wanting to put in another year. He had over 30,
mm-hmm.
but he was trying to work a deal where he had a home in Norfolk, and he was wanting to work it out to his benefit. And so he tried the same thing, and they said, oh, no. He said, you're not going to try that. You know, he said, one guy got away with it, and it's no longer something that an individual can do. So whatever happened, I guess it was kind of strange.
Okay. Well, sir, is there anything else you want to add to this interview?
No, I guess that's about it. I came home and I've never been in any business or anything. All we do is travel and
mm-hmm.
maintain the house and a couple of cars.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my friends, I've checked the internet, and they're in real estate and insurance. And,
mm-hmm.
I've gone into, you know, completed another tour, another profession.
Right.
Completely. But I guess I was a little lazy, and I'd get along fine doing all of our traveling and everything.
Uh-huh.
But I'll go ahead and send you a copy of my memoirs and that pamphlet I've got.
Okay.
And the only thing, the pamphlet, it's the only one I got. If, like I say, it's a little 4x6 manual,
mm-hmm.
about 140 pages. And
mm-hmm.
if one of your people could just burn a copy and then send this one back. I may never need it again, but once in a while, like with you,
mm-hmm.
I took a look at it again. But it covers 7th Air Force that networked throughout all of Vietnam. So it's with all the terms and everything, if you should ever wonder what these initials or whatever stands
mm-hmm.
for, you know,
mm-hmm.
you can look it up in the glossary there.
Okay. Sir, let me sign off really quickly.
Okay.
This will conclude our oral history interview with Colonel Jack Keith. And